You're listening to the official Travel Through History podcast. We're the producers. I'm Joe.
And I'm John. If you haven't heard our story yet, go back to the first episode. We kind of give you a little breakdown of how this all started.
In the meantime, the voice of the show, Jillian, will take you to our next destination.
Take it away, Jillian.
We've found a pot of gold on today's episode of Travel Through History. We'll journey to the luckiest little island in the Atlantic that just so happens to have the biggest history. I'm talking, of course, about Dublin, Ireland, where beautiful scenery and friendly people welcome you with open arms. First, we'll take you to one of the oldest universities in Europe, Trinity College, where we'll find the Book of Kells, a masterpiece that dates back to around 800 AD. Next, we'll visit Glasnevin Cemetery, the resting place of just about every famous political leader in Dublin's history. We'll also visit the General Post Office and Kilmainham Jail, two sites that marked the turning point in Ireland's fight for independence. Finally, we'll visit Ireland's National Cathedral, named for the patron saint of Ireland. You guessed it, St. Patrick. So get ready to experience Irish history as we explore one of the most sought-after destinations in Europe on today's episode of Travel Through History.
Control program confirmed.
They're known as the Fighting Irish, but without context, you won't understand why the Irish are so ticked off. For hundreds of years, they fought against British rule, and for a people known for their luck, we found very little of it in their history. From the potato famine that wiped out 25% of the population to their bitter war for independence, Ireland has had its share of rough times. Throughout it all, however, it is the resiliency of its people, and that's what gives Dublin its signature charm.
Dublin is a fabulous city in which to live because it allows two things. It allows one to get around the place very, very quickly. It's quite a small city. It's quite a homely city. It is a city about which we can all complain all of the time to one another and which we can defend vigorously if anyone else criticises us.
What do I love about the city of Dublin? The people, the fun.
We have probably the youngest city in Europe in that the population of Ireland is half the population is under 30. We still have large, relatively so, large families, and that gives us youth and, of course, that gives you vibrancy.
This is my city. It's my home city. It's a fabulous place. It's very young. It's very vibrant. It's got a great history as well. And I think the living culture in Dublin today reflects not just the Dublin of yesterday, but very much the Dublin of tomorrow.
But I think it is that small-scale intimacy that gives Dublin the feeling that people get when they come here. We're a very welcoming city.
Today, Ireland is one of the most visited destinations in Europe. Unfortunately, many conquering nations throughout history felt that same way. So let me help you get up to speed on how these happy-go-lucky people seem to actually have no luck at all. It's a long history, and they only gave me a few minutes, so here it goes. It's not widely known, but the Vikings actually settled off the coast of Ireland in the 9th century. The Gaelic Irish attempted to kick out the Norsemen many times, but never fully succeeded. However, the Normans invade around the 12th century and replace the Norse. The Gaelic Irish continue to stew with discontent for the next 400 years until Henry VIII gets involved. You might remember Henry VIII as the guy that tried to annul his marriage, but the Pope didn't let him, so he started his own church. We call it the Protestant Reformation, but it really becomes a catalyst of Irish oppression for the next 500 years or so. The English start moving to Ireland soon after and begin to build a Protestant presence. Now we've got a holy mess on our hands. In 1592, Queen Elizabeth I continued to develop a Protestant Ireland by founding Trinity College. It was modeled after Oxford and Cambridge in England, and it's the site of our first stop in Dublin.
Hello, my name is Joseph O'Gorman. I work here as a junior dean in Trinity College, Dublin. There had been a desire to found a university in Dublin for nearly 60 years. Now, we are the oldest university, but we're not the first. There were several papal attempts, an attempt by Parliament to found a university. All of these petered out or came to nothing. There was a great deal of talk, but nothing happened.
The Library of Trinity College is the largest research library in the country, and because of its historic standing, receives a copy of every book published in Great Britain and Ireland. That's over 100,000 books a year.
We're here in the long room of the Trinity College Library in Dublin, one of the finest architectural spaces in Ireland, and a place that is visited by hundreds of thousands of people every year to experience and soak up the atmosphere of nearly 40 centuries of human endeavor and learning.
A trip to Trinity College wouldn't be complete without visiting the oldest and perhaps most interesting book in the library's possession.
One of the reasons that people come to visit Trinity College is to see the Book of Kells, which is a manuscript dating from round about the year 800, produced in an island called Iona off the coast of Scotland. It's a gospel relic book. It was produced specifically for display, in the sense that people would come to see the decoration, design, and so forth within the book. The writing style that is used within the Book of Kells uses a very clear form, which means that it's extremely easy to read once you get used to it, but it gives it a very clear appearance on the page so that there can be no doubt as to what's been written. What is interesting, however, is how they manipulate the letters in order to fit words on the page. Sometimes at the beginning of the Gospels, for example, they will take the letters, switch them round out of their usual orientation, play them off against one another in order to get quite a large number of words onto the page. And these symbols and ideas and pictures were a way of allowing people read, as it were, who could not read the language, Latin, in which it is written. Of course, most people at that time would have been illiterate, so it could have been written in Martian, as far as they were concerned. It was to see a work of art that is inspiring, that shows the connection between belief, between ideas, faith, and artistic creation, all brought together with a very, very important text in the context of the development of Europe, and of course, the world.
Coming up next, we'll travel a few miles down the road and jump several centuries in time as our historical tour of Dublin continues. Every week, we post new episode information to our website, travelthroughhistory.tv. But we want to hear even more from our viewers. So like us on our Facebook page as well at facebook.com/travelthroughhistory. Tell us where we should go next or teach us something new.
Hey everybody, it's Joe and John, the producers of Travel Through History here. And one thing I wanted to mention to you guys was the only way that we're able to even make programming like this is through a charity. And our charity is called the Watch and Learn Foundation, and you can visit it by going to watchandlearn.org.
What Joe really means is that we have no idea how to sell the show. And although we've tried in the last 4 years, we haven't been successful at it. We can shoot, write, produce, edit. What else do we do?
Pretty much everything.
But we can't sell.
Yeah.
So if you're actually somebody listening that can help us sell the show, please call us, send us an email, anything, because we really want to keep doing more of these, and we'd actually like to pay our bills. But in the meantime, you can go to watchandlearn.org and make a donation.
That's right. That's www.watchandlearn.org, and donate and keep shows like Travel Through History and other educational shows on the air.
There's an old Irish proverb that says, "Life's too short not to be Irish," a fitting motto for today's Ireland, but back in the 1800s, Irish life was a little different, especially if you were a Catholic.
Hello, George McCulloch, Chief Executive of Glasnevin Cemetery, Ireland's National Cemetery here in Dublin.
Prior to 1832, Catholics in Dublin had no cemeteries to bury their dead. In fact, any Catholic services practiced in public were banned as a result of the defeat by the British in the Nine Years' War.
Under the penal laws in Ireland, Catholics did not have rights. Catholics couldn't hold public office, they couldn't be barristers, they couldn't be solicitors. One of those rights Catholics didn't have was the right to practice their religion or to own a grave to bury their dead.
Enter Daniel O'Connell, a prominent Irish political leader and a champion of Catholics' rights. O'Connell rose to power and eventually won the right to represent Irish Catholics in the British House of Commons.
O'Connell achieved Catholic emancipation in 1828. The establishment of Catholic cemeteries was the fulcrum for the full achievement of Catholic rights, very much like African-American rights in America.
O'Connell managed to create this cemetery just 15 years before he was buried in it, but he's more remembered for his politics.
O'Connell, known as the Liberator, he was probably the greatest politician of his era. He saw that the Irish people were as enslaved as much as the African American was enslaved.
It was this dedication to the people of Ireland that gained O'Connell the love and respect of the nation. Much of that is reflected in his final resting place.
The O'Connell Monument is a 170-foot high Irish round tower. It's the biggest in the world. Underneath is the crypt of Daniel O'Connell. O'Connell's remains are in that crypt in a lead-lined coffin along with eldest sons of subsequent generations.
O'Connell's crypt sits below a 168-foot tower named in his honor. The tower once allowed visitors to get a bird's-eye glimpse of Ireland until the year 1971.
Supposedly loyalists from the north who detonated a bomb in the tower in 1971, they blew the stairs clean out of it. If you look at the church here on my right, you'll still see the damage on the roof of the church where the stairs come out to the top, the huge cannon, and partially destroyed the church as well. And we plan next year to reinstall a staircase that went to the very top of the tower so that you could view all around Dublin.
The O'Connell Monument in Glasnevin is definitely a centerpiece of the cemetery, but that's not where this tour ends.
Come into Glasnevin Cemetery, Ireland's history is carved in stone. We have the greatest collection of Celtic crosses in the world. We have tens of thousands of Celtic crosses, art and stone art that exists nowhere else in the world and that will never exist anymore because the people and craftsmen who created that art are no longer in existence. In the cemetery lie side by side and together all of Irish history. Men and women who in their lifetimes would have gladly done away with each other, who politically were diametrically opposed to each other, in their final rest, they all lie here at Glasnevin Cemetery.
Glasnevin Cemetery signaled the beginning of a new era for Irish Catholics, but it wasn't an era of peace for either side.
There was a push for home rule since the 1850s. And home rule was the idea that they bring back a parliament to Ireland, but it'd be sort of like the Scottish parliament is today.
They wanted a chance to govern themselves, and this idea came close to working out. Then World War I happened.
And so they suspended the agreement and said that they would have come back to this agreement when the war was over. Now, there was a segment of the population who didn't want home rule. They wanted sovereignty. They wanted a complete break.
Irishmen and Irishwomen, in the name of God and of the dead generations from which she receives her old tradition of nationhood, Ireland, through us, summons her children to her flag and strikes for her freedom.
In an organized attack now known as the Easter Rising, volunteer armies took to several key Dublin locations under the command of Patrick Pearse, James Connolly, Thomas J. Clark, Sean McDermott, Joseph Plunkett, Eamon Kent, and Thomas McDonough.
We declare the right of the people of Ireland to the ownership of Ireland and to the unfettered control of Irish destinies to be sovereign and indefeasible.
These words were spoken by Patrick Pearse on the steps of the General Post Office in Dublin during the Easter Rising in 1916.
The GPO is the General Post Office, which obviously was and is still today a functioning post office. It played a very significant role in the history and the development of Ireland and Dublin in particular. Its role as a General Post Office was also made very famous in 1916, when it was occupied by Irish rebel forces during the Easter Rebellion. And that was a very significant period in our history.
The rebellion was brought down by the British after 6 days of fighting. The aftermath was devastating to Dublin and its population, with the majority of casualties being civilian men and women. The organizers were arrested and brought to Kilmainham Jail.
When they were arrested at the GPO, most of the people in Dublin were really angry with them because they had just helped destroy the city. And so there was no support for them. But the mistake that the government makes is executing them. They shouldn't have executed them, you know, especially Connolly. He had 3 wounds and they strapped him in a chair and shot him. Then the whole public opinion changed.
The Easter Rising may not have been an immediate success, but it helped to push Ireland in the direction of independence.
It played a very significant part in the formation of what became the Irish War of Independence and ultimately the Irish Treaty, which gave Ireland independence from Britain back in 1922.
For 500 years before Glasnevin, one other Catholic landmark played the role of final resting place for prominent Catholics. We're headed there next.
Hey, it's John and Joe, the producers of Travel Through History. The only way we can affordably produce these shows is with an invitation from our tourism board partners. They help show us around and get us where we need to be to tell the story.
Today's sponsor is visitdublin.com. What a treat it was for us to visit the Emerald Isle. Ireland has a fantastic origin story that continues right through to its independence. The sites we visited on the show, like O'Connell's Grave at Glasnevin Cemetery, St. Patrick's Cathedral, Trinity College, these are absolute must-sees.
Visit their site to learn more about the city's attractions and start planning a trip. Back to the show.
If Glasnevin Cemetery was the intended destination for most of Dublin's Catholics, then it's a safe bet that many of those buried there spent a lot of their time at our next location.
Hi, my name is Andrew Smith. I work for St. Patrick's Cathedral here in Dublin. I'm the education officer. St. Patrick was alive around 1,500 years ago, and there is a legend that he actually visited this site and used a well to baptize converts to the Christian faith. Now, of course, we'll never actually know if that really happened or not. But approximately 100 years ago, we found six Celtic grave slabs adjacent to the cathedral. And these slabs are around 1,000 years old. One of these slabs was actually covering the remains of what appeared to be an ancient well, which seemed to give some proof to the idea that St. Patrick was indeed here all that time ago.
Ancient baptisms aside, this isn't just a religious landmark.
I think personally that the cathedral is an iconic building in Irish history. It's played an enormous role in Irish history throughout the last 800 years. It's one of the oldest working buildings in the entire country. It's a genuinely medieval structure. It's got an enormous variety of things on display, including a huge amount of burials, monuments, and history associated with the building.
And where history is concerned, the cathedral is riddled with interesting tales.
One of the real selling points of this cathedral are the quirky stories that relate to its history. For example, we have a cannonball which is hung high up on the wall of the choir, and it was responsible for the death of a man named Adam Loftus, who strangely is actually buried directly beneath it. And we also have a boar's head on the top of the cannonball. So it's a very unusual object, and we don't have anything else like it in the building.
Lining the halls of St. Patrick's Cathedral are statues that have their own interesting stories.
The cathedral is full of a huge variety of statues to all manner of people. Some are clergy, some are judges, we even have a sailor. One of the statues relates to a man named Captain Boyd, who died tragically at sea. There's a legend, actually, that when he was buried in the cathedral, his Newfoundland dog came to the funeral and refused to leave his graveside. According to legend, popular legend, the ghost of the dog appears periodically around the cathedral.
Captain Boyd's dog has only been haunting the St. Patrick's for 200 years, but the cathedral is much older than that.
The cathedral was constructed in the 13th century, sometime between 1220 and 1260. So it's nearly 800 years old. And it was constructed on this spot because of a supposed connection with St. Patrick himself.
True to Gothic style, its massive size makes you feel a little small.
This is the National Cathedral for the Church of Ireland, and even though it's 800 years old, it's still the largest cathedral in Ireland. The style of the architecture in the cathedral is called Early English Gothic. Gothic architecture can usually be identified through pointed arches, especially above the windows. So it's designed to basically draw the eye upward and to make the visitor feel impressed by the space.
A lot of dust can settle in 800 years, and a deep cleaning has confused more than a few visitors.
One of the most common questions I get asked is, what's original? The basic structure of the building is still the same thing from 800 years ago, but the interior facings of the stones, the monuments, the glass, the tiles, most of those things have been added over the course of the last 800 years. The chapel at the east end of the cathedral is called the Lady Chapel, and it was constructed in 1270. Now, it's marginally younger than the rest of the cathedral. But actually, it causes confusion with our visitors nowadays because it appears much brighter and much cleaner than the rest of the building.
While the Ladies' Chapel may be a bit brighter than the rest of the cathedral, the choir area holds a few shining examples of early Catholic chivalry.
The area we're in at the moment is called the choir of the cathedral. It's often thought to be the most sacred part of the building. The area is decorated quite richly with a number of flags, helmets, and swords. These are all related to an organization called the Knights of St. Patrick. The Knights of St. Patrick was a chivalrous order of knights who were founded back in the 18th century by King George III. And if you were joining the Knights of St. Patrick, the ceremony would take place here in the cathedral. Today, the flags represent families who joined the Knights throughout the 18th and 19th century.
It's a historical place, but Dublin's famous cathedral didn't forget the modern wars and conflicts that tore the nation apart and rebuilt it.
I suppose one of the most interesting modern features which we've added to the cathedral is a new monument. It's the first new monument we've added to the cathedral in around 60 years, and it's called the Tree of Remembrance. And it's inspired by the centenary of World War I. Basically, it serves to remember all those who've been affected by conflict. And visitors to the cathedral are invited to leave a small message for a loved one who's been affected by conflict around the tree, tie it onto the barbed wire surrounding the tree.
We finish our tour of Dublin after the break. As you can see, there's much more to Dublin than just the Emerald Hills and Blarney Stones. It's a city rich with culture and history and friendly people that go out of their way to make you feel welcome. We hope you enjoyed our tour of this wonderful city and learned a little bit about its history. With such a beautiful place to live and play, the luck of the Irish is alive and well in Dublin.
Thanks for listening to Travel Through History. Don't forget to visit the website to learn more about the places we visited and some quick history.
That's www.travelthroughhistory.tv.